From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today we hear from the state about the recent stories of funeral homes leaving the bodies of adults and babies to neglect.
We are looking into all allegations, and we are going to hold them to the highest standards.
We hear about Proposal 3, which will put voters' rights in the state constitution.
We want to make sure that the will of the people is reflected. But are we maybe going too far by putting in the Constitution is the question we're asking.
We'll talk about a dust-up over ads critical of Proposal 2. They were pulled by a group of radio stations because of claims they were false.
What is the standard for a media outlet to say we're going to run an ad or not run an ad?
Plus, are the Democrats ignoring an important block of voters, African Americans in Detroit? All that and more coming your way. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. You probably have heard or read about fetal remains being found in funeral homes in Michigan. Some interments and cremations had already been billed and paid by Medicaid, yet the bodies were stored in closets or worse. It's up to the state's licensing and regulatory affairs to inspect funeral homes. Julia Dale is the director of the Corporation Security and Commercial Licensing Bureau within that agency. Welcome.
Thank you, Lester.
How do you go about keeping tabs on the funeral homes across the state?
That's a great question. We work from our licensing records, so not only are we charged with the inspection of these funeral homes within my bureau, but we're also responsible for the licensing and the renewal. There are 751 active licensed funeral establishments within the state, and we keep track of them using those active license records, also looking at the licensed managers for each of those establishments. That's how we, monitor their activity. That's how we make our decisions based upon what inspections we're going to do using that information.
So there's 751 funeral homes. They're supposed to be inspected every 3 years. How many inspectors do you have?
Well, let me just clarify that there is no statutory requirement for annual funeral home inspections.
No, every 3 years, I thought.
No, that is actually a policy decision that I had made indicating that, we know that we need to be out there doing regular inspections. So that's what we are looking to do, but it's not a statutory requirement.
Gotcha. Okay.
And so we have staff that would consist of an inspections manager who also does inspections and then three inspectors.
Are they able to get around to those 751 in every 3 years?
Sure are. So on a routine inspection where, we're going in and we're checking for things like appropriate ventilation, necessary permits, licenses displayed, our inspectors can actually do 2 to 3 of those depending on proximity and location in a given day for a routine inspection that's really without incident.
Have there been more inspectors in the past when perhaps your requirements weren't as stringent?
Inspectors, and I will say the program recently moved back to the Bureau here, so I don't know that I could speak to the number of inspectors that were dedicated to the program prior to that. I came in around 2016, and so I can share with you what we have been doing since that time, but I couldn't speak to exact numbers for inspectors dedicated prior to that.
I understand. These violations that we've been reading about and hearing about seem horrific to many of us. What does it take before your agency yanks the license of a funeral home or of a mortician?
Sure. That's a great question. And I will tell you that to us, these violations are also quite horrific. So when we become aware of these type of violations, when we walk into a place, for instance, like the Perry Funeral Home or the Cantrell Funeral Home or Swanson, we don't wait to shut them down or to take action. If we go in and notice that conditions are such that they should not be allowed to operate, and Perry's a great example, we were on site and we served that order and that suspension that same day.
Have other funeral homes in Michigan been found failing in honoring the people or infants that they were charged with interring or cremating?
So right now we have ongoing investigations, and I cannot speak to those because, again, we're in that investigative process. But I can tell you that we are looking into all allegations, and we are going to hold them to the highest standards.
I guess people are wondering, you know, hey, is this happening in my own hometown? Is this happening in, you know, the funeral home we've trusted for decades? And I suppose everybody's just a little suspicious right now because of some of these bad actors.
Certainly. I think most people, you know, read the news or they hear about these stories, and it does cause a lot of doubt and uncertainty. And I can tell you that, you know, just looking at the numbers of the funeral homes that we've inspected, the vast majority of funeral homes do not have the types of issues that we've seen more recently.
Are there exceptions to the rule besides the ones we've seen recently in the news that we should know about but haven't, just simply because the news media hasn't picked up on it?
No, I think again, there's not been a large number. This is not something we see regularly with our inspections. Again, the vast majority of the funeral home establishments are operating within the law, are handling business the way they should be.
So let's talk about the two Detroit funeral homes, Cantrell and Perry. Are they going to be able to get their license back?
We are still in the midst of our investigation there, so I could not speak to that.
Is it possible when somebody loses their license, is that a suspension or is that a revocation or can it be restored?
Those are all options currently with regard to both the Cantrell and Perry funeral homes. What you saw there were suspensions.
You've been at this job since 2016. Were you surprised at these findings, that these funeral homes we've seen lately in the news popped up kind of one right after another?
I think that, yes, I was surprised with it, but I don't think I'm the only one. I don't think the fact that I am newer in this position over the last couple of years, you know, is the cause for the surprise. I think what's the cause for the surprise, just like the public reading the stories, is just how horrific some of the, you know, some of the details are. You know, I think the average person is offended by, you know, what we're reading about.
Julia Dale is the director of the Corporation Securities and Commercials Licensing Bureau within the Michigan Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs, or LARA. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lester.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Former President Barack Obama is scheduled to appear in Detroit tonight to rally voters. That's as a recent Target Insight statewide poll found that 33% of black voters still don't know who Gretchen Whitmer is. She's the Democrat running for governor. Joining me now is a consultant who watches politics in Detroit and advises Democrats, Steve Hood. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, good afternoon.
So we should note right up front, you are working for one of the statewide Democrats, Dana Nessler, who's running for attorney general, right?
Complete disclosure, yes, I am.
Okay, great. So how enthused are black voters about this year's election?
The ones that we touch are enthused. The problem is we're not touching enough voters, directly touching the voters.
Are Democrats ignoring black voters in Detroit?
They're ignoring the uncomfortable areas of Detroit in general. If you look at a map of where Gretchen Whitmer actually lost to El Sayed and actually lost to Sri Thanadar in the primary, they're not going there.
What's the problem?
The Nestle campaign into those areas.
What's the problem? Why aren't they going there? If they know that they can pick up voters there or should be working to pick up voters there, why aren't they going?
They're uncomfortable with it. I don't know why they're not going there. I know that Sri Thanadar and I know that El Sayed did a really good job of going in there. And if you look at the map, it's a stark area. You can see it. It's a big hole. And that hole is what you need for victory this November.
Can Democrat candidates running for statewide office win without enthusiastic support from black voters in Detroit?
It is very, very hard because this race is so close. You need every vote and you need Detroit to turn out big time. And unless you go to those areas where you're uncomfortable, you're not going to get the turnout you need. In presidential elections, like when we did Barack Obama's election, the first one, everybody was fired up. All the uncomfortable areas, all the comfortable areas. Everybody was fired up. And you drove people to the poll. There's a mandate. That mandate is not there right now.
Obama is visiting Detroit to show support for Democrats. Will that have any impact in Detroit?
Unfortunately, they kept it to the same old, same old, the insiders. How were you notified that he was coming? How were you notified that there were tickets available? This morning, I told my trainer, who's from one of those uncomfortable areas, I told him at the gym that President Obama was coming. He jumped up and down and said, oh, man, I want to go. I wish I had known. I wish I had known. Where do I get tickets? There are no tickets left. And that he lives in one of those uncomfortable, well, he's from one of those uncomfortable areas that you need to turn out. That's where the problem is. So, I mean, CAS is a big auditorium, but they're not going to have the people that they really need to motivate. The people that are coming there tonight are already motivated to go out and vote. This is a rah-rah, cheer-cheer session. You need the people that are not motivated to see our greatest president ever.
All right, you're talking to your candidate. What should the other Democrats be doing to get into what you call these uncomfortable places to get these voters excited?
They've got to go on a massive GOT door-to-door flush in the uncomfortable areas.
Is it too late for
now,
that?
No. You can still cover it. You can still cover it in 1 week. If you switch your resources, you can still get there.
Steve Hood is a political consultant. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Have a great day.
Wildlife biologist at the Michigan Department of Natural Resources captured some rare images this month of cougars. They are from in Gogebic County. That's near the Ironwood area. The large cats were native to Michigan at one time, but trapping and hunting wiped out the state's cougar population around the turn of the 20th century. There have been 38 reports of cougars in Michigan since 2008. The DNR says there's no evidence that the cougars have a breeding population in Michigan. Genetic testing showed that previous cougars they've found came from populations in South Dakota, Wyoming, and Nebraska. They were just trekking through here. But still, maybe put away the meow mix if you're anywhere close to Ironwood. Coming up, we continue our interviews with congressional candidates around the state, plus what you need to know about the proposal to make it easier to vote.
So right now it takes an act of the person going in to say, yes, I want to be registered to vote. And this would sort of flip the script to say, we're registering you, okay?
Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We've been talking to congressional candidates around the state, and today we're taking you to the 11th District. It's an open seat. The Republican Lena Epstein is a businesswoman and worked for the Trump campaign in Michigan in 2016. The Democrat, Haley Stevens, worked on the financial bailout of GM and Chrysler. She's worked in advanced manufacturing and worked on the first Clinton and then Obama's 2008 campaigns. Haley Stevens joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Lester. Great to be here with everybody.
What in your background would make you a good choice to represent the people of the 11th District in Congress?
Well, I have had the privilege of working in federal government on behalf of Southeastern Michigan before. I served as the chief of staff on President Obama's U.S. Auto Rescue. This was the initiative responsible for saving General Motors and Chrysler and 200,000 Michigan jobs. We basically stood up for our entire regional economy, and that's what I want to go to Congress to do, is I want to be the best advocate for this region. Following from the auto rescue, I have spent time in skilled trades and workforce development. I've done STEM education programs, training the next generation for the jobs of the future. And that's also something I want to champion from the halls of Congress. I know how to bring people together for outcomes, common sense approaches, and making sure that our government is delivering for us.
Well, I wanted to hear more about your priorities, but I have to check on one thing because you used the term chief of staff. Back in July, the conservative Washington Free Beacon noted that your name of the position within federal government did not match the name of the position you claimed when you transitioned to the Auto Task Force. And since then, you've been attacked as lying about the title of your position. Can you shed some light on why you were called chief of staff when assigned to the Auto Task Force, and within the Treasury Department, you were identified as special assistant?
Well, you know, it's October in the election year when, you know, people start, you know, lying about your record. Look, I was proud to serve as the chief of staff on the U.S. Auto Rescue. I spent a lot of time with our suppliers communicating a lot of the tenets of the rescue to those companies and what the supplier support program would mean. You know, had my finger on the pulse with a lot of our mayors and township supervisors communicating and coordinating some of the you know, tenets of the auto rescue to them, and also just all the operations that we needed to do. And, you know, that was an unprecedented moment in our country's history. It was certainly something that was one of the most consequential federal initiatives for southeastern Michigan in a long time.
Well, I understand all of that, but that doesn't really answer my question. It's this conflict between title chief of staff and title special assistant. You call yourself chief of staff. I think the chair of the task force did as well. But why are you getting accused of lying?
You know, I'm going off of what my boss has said to me and the work that I did. I wasn't there to be a peacock, but I was there to serve our region and, you know, stand up for our economy. I was often the only woman in the room and oftentimes the only person from Michigan in the room. And, you know, the auto czar himself called me his chief of staff. And, you know, it's something that I'm proud to have been a part of, and I'll, you know, never make excuses for it.
Okay, let's talk about what you want for the district. What are your top three priorities?
So a couple of things. In terms of the three priorities, one, we need to get back in the business of ensuring that our federal government is delivering for us. I want to make sure that we have an infrastructure guarantee, that we are, you know, ensuring that every person has access to clean and safe drinking water, that we have maintained and safe roadways, and that we're seizing hold of the innovation opportunities. I think secondly, we want to make sure, and one of the things that I want to prioritize from the halls of Congress, Lester, is the value of human work and how we're valuing the skilled trades and the work that people are doing, so that we can create on-ramps to the middle class. And what that is that is prioritizing a 21st century labor movement. I think thirdly, what I'm going to be focused on from the halls of Congress are the next generation educational opportunities, championing our public schools, championing educational opportunities, ensuring that those who don't go on to a four-year degree have access to the skilled trades and a good paying job. And that starts with STEM education. That starts with equipping our schools with the best resources and tools to train that next generation of workers, as well as focusing on existing workers and making sure that they're getting the on-the-job training opportunities.
Now that you've been traveling the 11th Congressional District for months, what do you think it most needs from government?
I think what we really need is, you know, a pragmatic problem solver. We need somebody who's willing to roll up their sleeves, hit the ground running on day one, and deliver. I also believe, Lester, we need a listener in chief. There's a lot of talent. There's a lot of diversity in this district, a lot of different viewpoints. And I want to make sure that everyone knows that my line is always open to them. And, you know, we can take those approaches to really make our government work for us and also make people feel proud about who's serving them from the halls of Congress. There's a lot of speaking to and at each other, but I've really taken the approach on the campaign trail and how I intend to serve is by speaking among people.
Well, that gets to my next question. If you're elected, how likely are you to reach across the aisle and work with Republicans in Congress and within the Michigan delegation?
Well, Lester, you know, I've spent my career in a bipartisan way. Certainly the work that we did on the auto rescue, reaching across the aisle, that was a bipartisan initiative. There were Republicans and Democrats alike that helped us accomplish that, that that initiative. My work in advanced manufacturing and technology transfer and in workforce development has always been either bipartisan or frankly nonpartisan, and that's also been on the behalf of managing and effectively utilizing taxpayer dollars for outcomes. And so we've got to do business differently. I think we've got to elect a new generation of leaders and people who have the experience to deliver on day one.
The polls are showing the race in the 11th is pretty tight. There's been a lot of out-of-state money spent on supporting both campaigns, yours and your opponent's. So what do you think about the state of campaign funding as far as concerns about dark money and people out of your district, out of your state, trying to influence voters?
I'm very concerned about these super PACs, and I do believe we need to tackle campaign finance reform. I think we need to rein in the dark money. That's something that's a priority of mine from the halls of Congress. I think there's an accountability that our elected officials and our candidates owe to voters, and you get Paul Ryan, for instance. He gets some mysterious $25 million check from somebody, and no one knows who it came from, right? And it's just going into funding campaigns. And we're at a place where there's just got to be a reckoning, and there's got to be an approach to doing it differently.
Haley Stevens is the Democratic candidate running for Congress in Michigan's 11th District. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We reached out to Stevens' opponent, Republican Lena Epstein, for an interview. Her campaign did not respond to our requests. We've been looking at the statewide proposals on the ballot on November 6th, and today we're going to review Proposal 3, which would put certain voting rights into the Michigan Constitution. Joining us now is Eric Lufer, the president of Citizens Research Council of Michigan. The CRC did reviews of all of the proposals and has been helping us better understand them. Welcome back.
Thanks, Lester. It's great to be back.
Your analysis notes some, not all, of these voters' rights are already in state law, and you note that including them in the Constitution would make it more difficult for the legislature to make changes, such as it did by eliminating straight party ticket voting for this year's ballot. Let's go down the list of voting rights Proposal 3 would enshrine in the Constitution. First, protect the right to a secret ballot. How is that protected now?
So right now it is in the Constitution. It is in the very article and section of the Constitution that is being proposed for amendment. So that new section would say you have the right to a secret ballot, and oh, by the way, you have the right to a secret ballot. We would guarantee that twice in the same section.
Second, it ensures military service members and overseas voters are sent their ballots at least 45 days before an election. What's the law now?
So since 1986, federal law has told the states you have to send the absentee ballots out at least 45 days in advance to give our soldiers time to cast their absentee ballot and get them back in time to be counted. That was amended in 2009. There's nothing we can do at the state level to shorten that. We can do it a little earlier. But federal law says we have to meet that requirement and provide our soldiers, our absentee voters, the time to vote.
So again, no change.
No change.
Third is providing voters with a straight party voting option. And I'm wondering, how long did Michigan have that before this recent elimination?
It goes back to 1891. We are one of the first states to adopt straight party voting. And it's been part of our system for a long, long time.
And so if it goes in as part of the Constitution, it would take a mighty effort by the legislature to remove it again.
Yeah, heroic effort at that point.
Fourth is automatically registering citizens to vote when they get a driver's license or a state ID card. We get that opportunity now. How is this different?
The difference really is that you would be presumed to be submitting your name as a registered voter. So anytime you go in to get a license or ID card, they would say, we're also registering you to vote, and you have the opportunity to opt out. So right now it takes an act of the person going in to say, yes, I want to be registered to vote. And this would sort of flip the script to say, we're registering you, okay.
The fifth change is allowing a citizen to register to vote anytime, including on election day, with proof of residency. That's not happening now, right?
That's not happening now.
Opponents say that would cause an unnecessary burden to county and city clerks when they've got their hands full running an election that day anyway, the day of, let's say. They also suggest it might mean long lines at polling places because of confusion. How much merit is there in those concerns?
There is some merit, certainly. We're providing the opportunity to register up until voting day. Now, that registration would not occur at the polling place. You would have to go to your city clerk or your township clerk to do that and then take the documentation to the polling place. So there's always a chance that that little detail is lost and people get in line to vote and find out they're not registered and have to go to the clerk's office and come back. So it does some of that. But when you look at the number of people that are registered relative to the adult population, most of our residents are already registered to vote. We're not talking about that, you know, that great of a percent that it would really bog down the system.
Now, if we could get all of them to the polls. Sixth is no reason absentee voting. What's the law now?
The current law says that there are six criteria you have to meet to in order to receive an absentee ballot. You have to be away from home. You have to be incapacitated so you cannot travel to the polling place, issues like that. And this would just broaden it to say anybody who wants an absentee ballot qualifies and will mail it out to you.
Seventh is requiring audits of statewide election results. What's the practice now?
The practice now is that we have provisions in the Michigan election law to do this. We know from the last election, 2016, that there are some failings in the system, that not every vote seems to have been counted in the sort of documentation, the storing the ballots, things like that broke down in places. So this would strengthen it, but it strengthens a system that's already in place.
Would approval of Proposal 3 mean more voters actually get to the polls on Election Day, do you think?
You know, it's hard to know that. As I said, most of our residents are already registered to vote. The idea that you can automatically be registered doesn't create the incentive for you to vote, you know, so now we might have more registered voters not showing up just because we increased the number of registered voters. The fact that you can register up until voting day, we see this as sort of a two-step process. I want to be registered and I want to vote. If you separate those, you maybe lose the momentum. And if you allow that on election day, somebody's riled up, they want to be part of the system, we're going to include them. You've shrunk that time and that separation. So there's some push-pull on either side. It's not clear exactly that this goes very far in accomplishing the increased participation.
Now, the CRC mentioned in its report that there is concern about whether some of these things should be enshrined in the Constitution, and I've done some reporting on that in the past about all the stuff we've put into the Constitution. Should it actually be there? Should this be dealt with by statute? Do voting rights rise to the level of deserving to be in the Constitution? Not asking you to whether you approve of this or not, just wondering if this is something that seems right and proper for the Constitution.
Yeah, so our current Constitution as it's written now says you have the right to a secret ballot, and the legislature should provide the opportunity for voting. So it says, you know, we need to have the franchise, and it's a legislative responsibility to carry that out. You know, certainly voting rights come right up to the edge of that gray area between should it be legislative or should it be constitutional.
Clearly, in 1963, they thought at least some aspects of it should be included.
Sure,
in the Constitution.
And I think we can agree on that. The question today, we've evolved. Back in the 1960s when they were doing this, there was no contemplation of online voting or things like that. 50 years from now, where will we be? And will this Constitution prohibit us from evolving and doing more to include people where other states will have the flexibility because their statutes are dictating this and not the Constitution? Clearly, we want to have some protections. We've seen how the legislature has taken the will of the people and twisted it or ignored it at times. We want to make sure that the will of the people is reflected, but are we maybe going too far by putting in the Constitution is the question we're asking.
Eric Kalufer is the president of Citizens Research Council of Michigan. You can find analyses of all three ballot proposals at crcmich.org. That's crcmich.org. Of course, we'll have links to them at michiganradio.org on the stateside page. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come, a group of radio stations has removed a political ad because of claims that part of the ad is false.
The radio stations themselves have not said why they pulled them. And I just find that somewhat interesting. You know, what is the standard for a media outlet to say we're going to run an ad or not run an ad?
That story and more coming up. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. You might remember we recently talked to a Mexican journalist who's seeking asylum in the United States. Some major journalistic organizations are offering testimony, briefings, and evidence of Emilio Gutierrez Soto's credentials as a journalist. Yesterday, his case went back to an immigration judge, and things did not go as planned. Joining us now is Gutierrez Soto's attorney. His name is Eduardo Beckett. I understand the immigration judge, Robert Howe, lost parts of the case file. How does that happen?
Yeah, so this is a very irregular first time for me. I'm not sure what happened. It's still under investigation. I did call the Board of Immigration Appeals, and they even said that that I shouldn't be calling. This is an issue between the El Paso Immigration Court and the Board of Immigration Appeals. We've never seen this happen before. We don't know what happened. All I can tell you is that from our end, we send everything back when we do a remand, but we have no answer for you. So it's disheartening, right? Because as you mentioned, there's been some national organizations who have signed on to an amicus brief.
Right. I understand that the Missouri School of Journalism, the University of Michigan's Knight Wallace Fellowship Program all had statements in support of Emilio Gutierrez Soto. In fact, the Knight Wallace director, Lynette Clemenson, was there at the hearing, wasn't she?
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, in addition to the University of Michigan Knight Wallace Fellowship signing on as an amicus, you know, friend of the court, she personally came down to testify as to his credentials. And so it was disheartening to find out, one, that the judge or the court did not have those files of the amicus and all the substantial evidence that was filed, you know, country condition reports and how dangerous it is for journalists in Mexico, et cetera. Even a letter from Scott Busby, from the deputy director of the State Department, I believe from the Human Rights Division. Mm-hmm. So all this stuff is missing. And then the judge also says, oh, I don't need to hear from Ms. Clementon, right? And I was like, well, wait a minute. She just came all the way from Michigan to testify.
How normal is Judge Robert Howe's behavior in dealing with this case?
It seems to me that he's biased, but from a legal standpoint, what the judge is basically saying, he's saying, look, this is a remand, and the appeals court has ordered me to do a limited review of the case. I do not have to go back and look at, you know, whatever was filed previously. I don't have to look at new evidence. My job is only to look at what was filed in the appeals court, consider that, and then issue a new decision. So he's saying, you have no right to present Ms. Clemenson from the University of Michigan as a witness. You have no right to even have Emilio Gutierrez Soto testify. You have no right to even file new evidence, which I find, on a legal standpoint, you know, I'm challenging that. It appears to me that the appeals court said that the case was going to be sent back so the judge could review new evidence that was not available before. And Lynette Clemenson is new material evidence, because she awarded a very prestigious fellowship to my client, Emilio Gutierrez Soto. You know, it's a very prestigious award, a very prestigious university, and it felt like the judge was minimizing that.
I want to ask you about one other thing in this case that's odd. Although he's never been charged with any kind of crime, Gutierrez Soto was targeted by ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Do you know why he was on this target list?
through a FOIA, through the National Press Club, I believe through their nonprofit institute, they did a FOIA and discovered that my client, Emilio Gutierrez Soto, was on a list being targeted by ICE. And the only conclusion that we could see the evidence showed and pointed, it was simply for exercising his First Amendment rights. Mr. Emilio Gutierrez has been an open critic of corruption in Mexico within military ranks. But in addition to that, when he saw how they treat asylum seekers as criminals and him as a journalist, he was very offended that he came to our borders to seek help and never thought in his mind that he would be treated like a criminal. So he criticized Immigration Customs Enforcement, Texas side, and the U.S. government, you know, DHS, Department of Homeland Security. And so they put him on this target list, and we filed a federal lawsuit. And one of the interesting things is that we alleged all these things, and ICE never responded to that. They never said, oh, no, that's not true. So it leaves you with the notion that we were 100% correct.
What's next in this case?
For us to file a legal brief with Judge Robert S. Howe, and then in January of 2019, the judge will write up an opinion. We're asking that the case be removed to Michigan, where my client lives at, where he's doing his fellowship, and that's still to be decided, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Eduardo Beckett is an immigration attorney in El Paso, Texas, who is representing award-winning journalist Emilio Gutierrez Soto as the Justice Department tries to deport him for unspecified reasons. Mr. Beckett, thanks very much.
Pleasure to be with you. Bye-bye.
I need to make a quick correction. In the intro, I said the hearing was yesterday. It was actually on Monday. In a rare occurrence, a group of radio stations removed a political ad about Michigan's Proposal 2, the proposal to establish an independent commission to draw redistricting maps to end gerrymandering. Here to talk about that pulled ad are our Friday political commentators, Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican legislative leader. He joins us via Skype. Vicki Barnett, the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. The group behind Proposal 2 is Voters Not Politicians. Apparently, that group made a convincing argument that the political ad that was running against its proposal was misleading. 19 stations in the Michigan Brownfield Network pulled the ads, and here's the part of the ad that's being called false.
Proposal 2 writes a blank check to 13 new commissioners for a new bureaucracy, and they can spend whatever they want. No limits on staffing, lawyers, or consultants, or themselves. Unlimited pay and perks.
The group which placed the ads, the DeVos-backed Michigan Freedom Fund, on behalf of a group called Protect My Vote, says the ads are accurate. And Tony Dott was on the program recently and said this about the proposal.
If they spend $20 million, if they spend $50 million on this, there's no way to hold them accountable. They are accountable to no one. They are accountable to themselves and themselves only.
Ken Sikkema, what's your take on this?
Well, that's a bit of a stretch in terms of both the ad and what Mr. Dawn is saying. I do think it's important to kind of unpack things a bit, Lester, on this, because I think there's sort of three separate issues. One is, you know, how do you feel about Prop 2? And I have reservations about it. And then you have these ads against it, and are they misleading? And yes, I think they are misleading. I mean, I got the mailer that basically says the same thing as the radio ad, and I really cringed when I got it, in spite of my reservations about the proposal. But the third issue, I think, is a little bit more dicey and complex, and that's the question of whether these radio stations should refuse to run them. And I think that's a bit of a sticky wicket, because if the reason for not running them is that they're misleading, false, and have material factual errors in them, I would argue that most of the ads being run right now then wouldn't pass muster.
Vicki, what do you think about the truth of this ad or the claims by Michigan Freedom Fund on behalf of Protect My Vote?
Well, part of what they were saying is somewhat accurate, that there are 13 commissioners who can spend money, but unlimited, no. That's, they're under oversight of the Secretary of State under Proposal 18.2. So it is factually incorrect. And we're seeing a lot of factually incorrect ads, but there's two kinds of ads that are running. One is a candidate ad paid for by candidates, approved by candidates. And there are no restrictions on what they can say in those ads, and they have to be run. The second type of ads is what we're talking about here, which are ads produced by independent groups with no coordination with a candidate or campaign. They can spend unlimited amounts of money without identifying their donors, and those are where most of the negative attack ads are coming from, with a lot of falsehoods in them.
By the way, the well-respected Bridge Magazine Truth Squad called a foul on that ad, writing that it uses a combination of scare tactics, exaggeration, and falsehoods to reach unsubstantiated conclusions. Now, let's go to that bigger argument that both of you have been talking about, and that's, are there lies in political advertising? I think we all agree, yeah, there occasionally are lies in political advertising, right?
Glad you brought up the Truth Squad from Bridge that called a foul on this ad, because they've called a foul on lots of ads this election season. And to my knowledge, none of the other ones have been pulled by any media outlets. And that's kind of the point here is, if you're going to pull this ad or refuse to run it, then, why are you not pulling these other ads that the Truth Squad has labeled as foul? I just think that's what I call the sticky wicket here. And the group supporting Proposal 2 requested the ads be pulled, and they have talked about it, but the radio stations themselves have not said why they pulled them. And I just find that somewhat interesting. What is the standard for a media outlet to say we're going to run an ad or not run an ad?
Okay, so Vicki, I want to get to you soon, but I want to make this clear. There are two standards, actually, and that is under FCC rules, a radio station or TV station may not pull the ad of any federal candidate, and in this case, that also means the governor, their ad. But any other ad is fair game. A radio station or a TV station who feels that there's a falsehood in that can refuse to run that ad. So the question is, if that's the case, why are so many TV stations and radio stations running ads that have been shown to be false? Vicki?
Well, I think that talks about exactly what I mentioned earlier, that a candidate ad produced by a candidate, run by a candidate, paid for by a candidate, and approved by a candidate is treated differently than an ad produced and created without the coordination of a candidate and using outside PAC money, or what we call this dark money world that started under Citizens United back in 2008. So I think there's a difference in candidate ads. One is produced by the candidate, and those are the ones that stations and outlets are always running, and by extrapolation from the FCC that you just mentioned, if it's a candidate ad, they'll run it. If it's not a candidate ad and it's an outside ad, stations have the right to not run them if they find them too blatantly false. However, most stations continue to run them because of the slippery slope that you're just talking about. If they pull the ads, does that mean the station is now supporting the proposal outright? Or if they pull the other side's ads, are they not supporting the proposal or the candidate? It does become a very sticky wicket, and we're talking about free speech, which is a guaranteed right in our Constitution. Look, I think everybody's sick of negative ads. Everybody's sick of the lying. We can't wait for the elections to get over, and this happens every single election cycle. And we're going to have to come to grips with identifying outside PAC money. Should it be controlled? Should it be limited? Or should at least we go for disclosure of all of those donors so the public has the right to see who's paying for what ads?
I wish we had more time to talk about this. I've got one quick story I think I might have shared before. I was sitting getting a haircut, and an older person down the row was talking about the ads and the terrible things that they were saying about the candidates, and then added, but they must be true, otherwise they wouldn't let them put them on the station. And that's just not the case. Ken, any final words?
Well, I don't like the ad. I don't like Proposal 2, but I also think the ad's misleading. I'm just not sure the radio station should have pulled it.
Vicki, final words?
I'm not sure the radio station should have pulled it either, but voters have a right to disclosure of who donates money to run the particular ads that we're talking about.
Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Lester.
It's the season for jack-o'-lanterns, trick-or-treating, and, of course, haunted houses. Have you ever wondered how all those ghouls and goblins who jump out at you get ready for the haunting season? At Erebus Haunted Attraction in Pontiac, they go to Boo School. Stateside's April Van Buren went and brought us this postcard.
My name's Jerome Helton, and I'm the director of entertainment.
This is going to go fast today because normally it's a three-day course. We shoved it into 2 days, and guess what? Today we're shoving it in one whole day for you.
Boo School is something that we just kind of created, and we love it because we looked at it as, okay, the industry has changed. We went from black plastic walls to, you know, these high-tech walls now and all kinds of cool stuff. And it's like, what, the acting did not change. So it's like, well, we got to get better actors. How do we do better actors? Well, they need to be trained.
Make yourself it. There's no right or wrong. Just do a bit. Big there you go. That's better. Big arms.
When we give the actors tools to work with and we teach them techniques and we give them the philosophy behind Haunt and Halloween and the season, it helps them get more into the characters. It's kind of like, you know, what's my motivation as an actor? I need a motivation. So this is their motivation.
Some say that on All Hallows Eve, wayward souls of the dead roam the earth once more.
These traditions and legends of Halloween start to play into people's baggage. And that's something that we can exploit as scare actors.
My name is Jennifer Petrovka, and I am the director of entertainment at Erebus Haunted Attraction. So the purpose of Boo School is to get our actors all on the same page. It also establishes that family at the beginning because they're all doing things that make themselves look ridiculous, and they all see each other doing it. So they're kind of starting to bond that way.
We play some games that help with improv.
So this is called Going for a Ride.
As you're going through as an actor, scare actor, and you're playing this character, sometimes you get caught off guard, or you come around a corner, you hit a group of people. You got to be able to be quick on your feet.
So we are driving. Where are we driving to?
Hell. Boon races.
Where?
Hell.
And where are we going to Hell, Michigan?
Ice cream.
Then as we go throughout the day, we're starting to get to the nuts and bolts of how do you actually scare. So are we talking about stomping your foot? Are we talking about slapping a wall? You know, different ways that you can move your body.
A little bit like a hunchback, your hunches move. Maybe like an older person. Bear, I think you're pulling off like Neanderthal, right, with your swinging arms?
When we first started out, unique things were a pop-out where you'd have a puppet come out from, believe it or not, a plastic black screen. If you coordinated the spotlight perfectly, it was a really intense scare. My name is Bobby Kutz Courtney. I am one of the icons here at Erebus. I've been scaring since 1980. I play the ringmaster.
Ladies and gentlemen!
Yes!
Little ghouls and boys of all ages! Welcome to the greatest haunted house in the world!
What makes a good scare actor is being able to not only be a frightener, but also to be an entertainer. I want my people to come back here. I want them to tell everybody that Erebus scared the pants off of me, but I don't want them to be terrorized saying, I wet myself and I'm not ever going back there.
So in Haunt, in the Haunt world as Haunt actors, we have a tradition. And it's called the Boo School Pledge.
Pledge allegiance to the hat.
You cannot have a group of individuals that are all, in their own minds, the best ever to haunt. Actors that are without ego and they're working together and they are a family, they're supporting each other and they know that, okay, this time I'm not going to get the big scare, somebody else is, but we collectively are scaring the crap out of people.
We're off! Yeah! Congratulations, guys. Right. Yeah. Welcome to the Haunt family.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Tony Brown. Stateside's executive producer is Jill Lindstroth. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.